The barracks at Stalag Luft 1 were cold in the way that only Baltic coast cold can be. Damp, persistent. A cold that came off the water and settled into the bones of the men sleeping in those wooden bunks and didn't let go until summer, which was still months away in the spring of 1945. Those men were Allied airmen, American and British mostly, shot down over occupied Europe, processed through the German prisoner of war system, and now sitting behind wire near a town called Barth in northern Germany, eating potato soup and waiting. Waiting for the war to end, waiting for news, waiting for something to happen. One of them was done waiting. His name was Bob Hoover. He was 23 years old. He weighed maybe 140 pounds. He was a United States Navy fighter pilot from Nashville, Tennessee, and he had been a prisoner for 16 months. And in April of 1945, he walked away from a work detail, made his way to a German airfield, found an airplane on the flight line, and flew himself out of Germany. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. And today I want to tell you about the man that Jimmy Doolittle called the greatest pilot he ever saw. Pull up a chair. This one earns it. Before we get into it, a word about today's sponsor, AviationSoul.com. They make aviation challenge coins for every milestone that matters in this life of flying. First solo, private certificate, instrument rating, commercial. If you earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story about where you've been. Check them out at AviationSoul.com now. Robert Anderson Hoover, Nashville, Tennessee, born January 24, 1922. And from the time he was a small child, airplanes were not a passing interest. They were the thing. The only thing that organizes world in a way that made complete sense to him. He grew up during the golden age of barnstorming and air racing. He watched biplanes doing things overhead that most adults told him were impossible. And instead of believing the adults, he believed the airplanes. He was 17 when he first got his hands on the controls. He talked a crop duster into letting him ride along, then talked him further into letting him handle the stick. And from that moment, anyone who flew with Bob Hoover knew they were in the presence of something unusual. Not recklessness, not showing off, something more precise than that. A feel. An instinct for what an airplane was about to do, a half second before it did it. He talked his way into a ground school course by lying about his age. He soloed before his 18th birthday. He was building time any way he could when the war came, and he walked into a Navy recruiter's office and talked his way into a fighter pilot seat with the same combination of charm and demonstrable ability that had been getting him into cockpits since he was a teenager. He was assigned to a naval aviation unit operating in the Mediterranean theater, flying Spitfires alongside the British, and in 1944 on a mission near Cannes, France, a German fighter found him before he found it. His Spitfire took hits. The airplane was done. He went over the side. And just like that, one of the most gifted pilots in the American military was a prisoner of war. Stalag Luft 1 held thousands of Allied airmen by the time Hoover arrived. It was not a death camp, but it was not comfortable. The food was inadequate. The cold was relentless. The psychological weight of confinement is something that people who haven't experienced it can only approximate from the outside. You are a person defined by motion, by speed, by the freedom of altitude, and now you're behind wire, in the mud, watching the seasons change through a fence. But Hoover watched other things too. He watched the guards. He watched the routines of the camp. He watched the airfield that sat near the compound. And he thought. What he thought essentially was this. If the war is ending, and it clearly was by early 1945, the chaos of that ending creates windows, opportunities, moments when the system that is holding you has other things on its mind. In April of 45, he found his window. He slipped away from a prisoner war column, moved through the perimeter, made his way to the German airfield nearby.
And there on the flight line sat a Focke Wulf 190. Now, the Focke Wulf 190 was one of the finest fighter aircraft the Luftwaffe produced. A radial-engined single-seat interceptor that had given Allied fighter pilots serious problems since it appeared over the English Channel in 1941. It was powerful. It was fast. It was not a forgiving airplane for a stranger. The cockpit was German. The labeling was German. The power and handling characteristics were entirely different from anything Hoover had flown before. Bob Hoover climbed into it, figured it out on the spot, and flew it to the Netherlands. He landed in a Dutch field, walked out of the airplane, eventually connected with Allied forces and made it back across the lines. He was done being a prisoner. Now here's what I want you to sit with for a moment. He had never flown that aircraft type before. He had been in captivity for 16 months. He was running on prison rations and pure nerve. And he looked at an unfamiliar enemy fighter, worked out the systems well enough to start it, taxi it and get it airborne, and navigated it across occupied territory to safety. That is not a normal human being doing a brave thing.
that is a pilot at the absolute peak of what a pilot can be. After the war, Hoover didn't go home to Nashville and sit on the porch. He went straight to Wright Field in Ohio as a test pilot. And in the post-war test pilot world, he found his people, engineers and evaluators and pilots who thought the way he thought, who cared about the same things he cared about. What does this airplane actually do? Where is the edge? What happens when you find it? His reputation at Wright Field grew fast. There was a quality to his flying that was difficult to describe, technically, but impossible to miss. He could take an aircraft to its limits and bring it back without drama. He could feel things in the machine that other pilots, talented pilots, would miss entirely, a subtle buffet. The beginning of departure. The slight change in control forces that told you the aerodynamics were about to do something different.
The community of military test pilots in that era was small and extraordinarily talented. Hoover was recognized as exceptional, even within that group. And when the Bell Aircraft Corporation had finished building a rocket-powered research plane called the Bell X-1, and when the Army Air Forces selected a young pilot named Chuck Yeager to attempt the first supersonic flight, they needed someone flying Chase. Someone fast enough to observe. Someone skilled enough to be useful if something went wrong. They selected Hoover on October 14, 1947. Over the Mojave Desert, Chuck Yeager pushed the X-1 through Mach 1 in glamorous Glennis, and Bob Hoover was in a P-80 Shooting Star above and behind, watching. He was there the morning the sound barrier fell, not on the nose of the famous airplane, but close enough to witness it. A footnote in history, but a footnote Bob Hoover earned. He moved from Wright Field to North American Aviation as a test and demonstration pilot. North American built some of the most significant aircraft of the era, the F-86 Sabre, the F-100 Super Sabre. Hoover flew them all, evaluating performance, demonstrating capabilities to military buyers, pushing envelopes that most pilots weren't cleared to push, but his real legacy. The thing that made Bob Hoover a name that pilots say the way musicians say certain names came from the air shows. Starting in the 1950s and continuing for more than four decades, Bob Hoover was the standard by which airshow performance was measured, and what made him extraordinary was not what he flew. It was how he flew it. His aircraft of choice, the one that became inseparable from his name, was a Rockwell Shrike Commander, a twin-engine piston business airplane, powered by a pair of Lycoming engines. The kind of aircraft executives flew to sales meetings. Not a warbird, not a jet, not a purpose-built aerobatic machine. Hoover made it dance. The routine began like any other airshow act. He would take off, climb, and begin an aerobatic sequence. Rolls, loops, cubinates, hammerhead turns. Combinations of maneuvers that were completely outside the design envelope of a twin-engine business aircraft, performed with the smoothness of a man doing something he had done 10,000 times and found effortless. The crowd would be impressed. They were always impressed, but then came the moment. Somewhere in the sequence, Bob Hoover would reach into the cockpit and shut down both engines. Not one, both. The noise changed completely. Where there had been the steady drone of those Lycomings, now there was silence and wind, dead stick, no power, just the stored energy in the aircraft and whatever altitude he had built, and he would keep flying. He would continue the aerobatic sequence, rolling a twin-engine business aircraft, dead stick, using only energy management and his own hands to stay coordinated and controlled. Then he would set up for landing, still no engines. He would grease that Shrike Commander onto the runway with the kind of precision that made professional pilots in the crowd put their hands over their mouths. And as he rolled out on the runway, coasting now, the airplane decelerating on the pavement, Bob Hoover would reach into the cockpit and pour himself a glass of iced tea, cleanly, without spilling a drop. The crowd would erupt, but the point wasn't the showmanship of the pour. The point was what the pour demonstrated. After shutting down both engines, completing an aerobatic sequence in a business aircraft, and landing dead stick with no go-around option available, Bob Hoover's hands were completely steady. No tension, no release, just smooth, controlled motion. That was the message. That was what 50 years of paying attention to airplanes looked like from the outside. Neil Armstrong watched Hoover fly. Neil Armstrong, who had flown experimental aircraft over Edwards, who had guided a lunar module to the surface of the moon on manual control when the computer was overwhelmed and the fuel was almost gone. That Neil Armstrong looked at Bob Hoover and said he was the greatest stick and rudder man who ever lived. Jimmy Doolittle, who led 32 aircraft in a low-level surprise raid on Tokyo in 1942, who flew the first instrument-only flight in 1929, who had seen more aviation than almost any man alive, called Hoover the greatest pilot he ever saw. Those are not compliments that get handed out casually in that community. But the story still isn't finished. Because in 1992,
the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, suspended Bob Hoover's medical certificate.
He was 70 years old. The FAA's aviation medical examiners reviewed his case and concluded that he showed evidence of age-related neurological impairment, that he was no longer safe to fly as pilot in command. They grounded him. The reaction from the aviation community was immediate and intense. Letters and declarations came from some of the biggest names in American aviation history. Chuck Yeager wrote in support. Jimmy Doolittle lent his name. Test pilots, airline captains, airshow performers, general aviation pilots from every corner of the country said the same thing in different words. This man is sharp. This man is capable. The evaluations are wrong. Hoover retained legal counsel. He submitted to additional neurological testing from specialists outside the FAA's process. He underwent evaluation after evaluation. He cooperated completely with a process that many people believed was treating him unjustly, and for 3 years he was grounded. 3 years, a man who had been flying since he was 17, who had escaped a German prison camp by stealing a fighter aircraft, who had been demonstrating complete mastery of complex aircraft for 5 decades. 3 years without a certificate. The case became one of the most publicized pilot versus regulatory authority disputes in the history of American aviation. The Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, known as AOPA, took up his cause actively.
The battle went through the administrative hearing process, through appeals to the National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB. It became a conversation about how the FAA evaluates aging pilots, about the reliability of the testing instruments used, about what due process looks like when the stakes are a man's ability to fly. In 1995, after 3 years of legal and administrative combat, the FAA restored Bob Hoover's medical certificate. He flew again. He performed again. At air shows, the reception he got when he returned to the circuit was something that witnesses describe as genuinely emotional, not just applause, something more like relief, like the crowd was exhaling something they had been holding. He eventually retired from airshow performance on his own terms. In his own time, he transitioned into a role as an ambassador for aviation, speaking at events, giving interviews, being the thing that he had earned the right to be, a living piece of the history of American flight.
Bob Hoover died on October 25, 2016. He was 94 years old. And the aviation world did what it does when someone irreplaceable leaves it. It got quiet for a moment. And then it started telling stories. There's a philosophy embedded in Hoover's flying that he articulated a number of times over the years. He used to say that when you're faced with a forced landing, you should fly the airplane as far into the crash as possible. What he meant was not that you should be reckless about it. What he meant was that you should never give up control, never check out, never accept that the outcome is determined before the wheels stop moving, because as long as your hands are on the controls and your mind is engaged, you still have options. He didn't mean that just for emergency situations. He meant it for every phase of flight. Stay in the airplane, think, manage what you have. The pilot who keeps flying until the airplane stops has a better chance than the pilot who mentally parks in the left seat before the runway disappears. That philosophy is not complicated. But living it requires a particular kind of discipline that you have to develop intentionally. Hoover developed it over decades, in the test pilot programs and the airshow circuits and the thousands of hours of practice that his public performances rested on. What looked like natural genius was also a habit of mind that he built deliberately. Pilots have a tendency to turn great performers into something supernatural, to say they were born with it, as though the work they put in was incidental. Hoover was gifted, there is no question about that. But he also showed up and flew every day. He also ground flew maneuvers in his head before he flew them in the airplane. He also asked the machines what they were capable of and listened carefully to the answers. That's what the Shrike Commander routine was really about, not just the skill required to do it, but the years of building that skill, deliberately and methodically, until it became something that looked effortless. Nobody pours a glass of iced tea after a dead stick landing because they got lucky. They do it because they made themselves ready for that moment, long before the moment arrived.
I think about that sometimes when I'm in the pattern. Not the iced tea, just the readiness. The idea that what you do when things go sideways has already been decided by everything you did before things went sideways. Bob Hoover made himself ready for 16 months in a prison camp. For a stolen airplane he'd never flown. For a sound barrier crossing he watched from the chase aircraft. For 40 years of air shows where failure meant failure in front of thousands of people. He made himself ready. And then he showed up. Primary sources for today include Hoover's memoir, Forever Flying, co-written with Mark Shaw, along with reporting from AOPA Pilot Magazine, Aviation Week, and the archived coverage of his FAA medical case. You can find us at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Fly the airplane as far into the crash as possible. Bob Hoover told us that it's worth remembering.